Today we're continuing the series entitled More to Life, Learning from the Life and Leadership of Nehemiah. Now Nehemiah was leader of the Jewish people in about 445 BC, so it's quite a time ago, but I think there are things that we can learn from what he did. This is part three of the story of Nehemiah, and it's entitled A Barrage of Bullies. I will be reading extracts from an Old Testament book, which is the book of Nehemiah, chapter 4, and I should be reading them in the contemporary English version. And as we go along, I'll be posing a series of questions, and the first of those questions is, what did the bullies want? Now, a lifetime ago, Britain had a conservative prime minister, and the cabinet were in disagreement as to the best way to deal with a united Europe. Some senior conservative ministers thought they could bully the prime minister into seeing things their way. The prime minister was left in no doubt that opposition to the bullies could lead to the sack if things went wrong. And they say history doesn't repeat itself. The year was 1940, and the conservative bullies at that time wanted the prime minister to negotiate a peace agreement with that nice Mr. Hitler. The Nazi bully had invaded Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Denmark, Norway, Holland, Belgium, and France, and was about to annihilate most of the British army at Dunkirk. Despite this, the bullies believed that Mr. Hitler would surely give Britain a favourable peace deal. The response of the Prime Minister was to offer the nation nothing but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. That Prime Minister, as you know, was Winston Churchill, who was a flawed individual who'd made many mistakes in his life and had many character flaws. But one of his character strengths was courage. In his younger days, he'd survived a cavalry charge in battle, and he'd fought in the trenches in the First World War. Now, as Paul told us 2 weeks ago in part two of this series, one of Nehemiah's character strengths was courage. Also in his character armory was, as Astrid told us, a dependence on the divine. You see, Nehemiah believed that God had placed him in Jerusalem and given him materials to rebuild the walls with the blessing of the Persian king, who was their overlord. But the first thing Nehemiah had to face in this task was the bullies. We read in chapter 2 of Nehemiah, when Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem the Arab heard about our plans, they started insulting us and saying, "Just look at you. Do you plan to rebuild the walls of the city and rebel against the king?" I answered, "We are servants of the God who rules from heaven, and he will make our work succeed. So we will start rebuilding Jerusalem. But you have no right to any of its property because you have had no part in its history." See, the hidden agenda of the bullies was to be top dogs locally and do as they wished. For years, they dominated the Jews militarily and economically. They could probably buy any property they wanted in Jerusalem cheap. What the bullies wanted is for the Jews to remain cowed, relying on a God who appeared helpless to intervene. What the bullies wanted was for them to have a defeated mindset and live in fear of invasion in their vulnerable city. A fortified, prosperous Jerusalem, occupied by a confident people, was the last thing that the bullies wanted, and they would stop at nothing to prevent that happening. And the first few verses of chapter 4 of Nehemiah say this: when Sanballat, the governor of Samaria, heard that we were rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, he became angry and started insulting our people. In front of his friends and the Samaritan army, he said, "What is this feeble bunch of Jews trying to do? Are they going to rebuild the wall and offer sacrifices all in one day? Do they think they can make something out of this pile of scorched stones?" Tobiah from Ammon was standing beside Sanballat, and he said, "Look at the wall they are building. Why, even a fox could knock over this pile of stones." I wonder whether you knew that Hitler's favorite German philosopher was Friedrich Nietzsche, who famously declared that God is dead. Nietzsche's thinking became the basis of Nazi philosophy. The Nazi bullies wanted the British to remain cowed, relying on a God who was dead. They wanted them with a defeated mindset and living in fear of invasion in their vulnerable islands. Victory and total domination would be the reward for the Nazi bullies. But when Nehemiah was confronted with the bullies that wanted to keep Jerusalem in chains, it says in Nehemiah 4, "But I prayed, 'Our God, these people hate us and have wished horrible things for us. Please answer our prayers and make their insults fall on them. Let them be the ones to be dragged away as prisoners of war. Don't forgive the mean and evil way they have insulted the builders.'" So that's what the bullies wanted. But what did the people want? Seeing the film Darkest Hour recently gave me another leader in Winston Churchill who had to face a barrage of bullies. Now, the film was factual based, with some imagined but quite possible events intertwined. And Winston Churchill was a leader who wanted to take the people with him, and he used his radio broadcasts to do that. But in his darkest hour, when he seemed to stand alone in his desire to fight on, and it seemed a seemingly impossible task, he, in the film, took his first ever ride on the tube. And people on the tube recognized him. But he didn't behave like a modern-day celebrity. But he asked them their names. And he asked them what they thought we should do. They encouraged him to believe that the ordinary people of Britain, who were suffering the depredations of war and the loss of loved ones, wanted him to fight on. And that inspired him to broadcast, "We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight in the fields. and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. Now that sounds like very warlike and unchristian-like words to our safe, modern Christian ears. But back in 1940, ordinary people, young and old alike, volunteered to defend their country. My mother joined the WAF and only told my grandmother afterwards, because she knew my grandmother would have tried to stop her. My father, aged only 19, volunteered to fight in a war 12,000 miles away from his safe home in New Zealand. He wasn't alone. 10,000 other young Kiwi aircrew volunteered. As a 21-year-old pilot with RAF Bomber Command, he had only a 50% chance of survival. I don't think that I've inherited the courage gene from either of them, but maybe it's never been put to the test. Older people also wanted to do their bit. Some of them joined Dad's army. And if you've ever watched that on television, you'll know that the opening song has a defiant response to the Nazi bully. Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think old England's done? Nehemiah, you know, was also a leader who wanted to take the people with him. And faced with the apparently impossible task in a ruined city, this is what he said to the people. We read it from Nehemiah 2. But when I got back, I said to them, Jerusalem is truly in a mess. The gates have been torn down and burned, and everything is in ruins. We must rebuild the city wall so that we can again take pride in our city. Then I told them how kind God had been and what the king had said. Immediately they replied, let's start building now. So they got everything ready. You know, Nehemiah's motivation wasn't just to make Jerusalem prosperous and safe. He knew that God's reputation as a God who could protect his people was on the line. Rebuilding Jerusalem in the face of local opposition would be a witness to God's power and love of his people. Now, what the people had to do, as we'll see in this next slide that goes up, is no easy task. They're not building with clay bricks, like on the right, but they're shifting huge stones, like on the left. And Nehemiah chapter 3, which we haven't read, tells us that the people, this is what the people had to do, that the people under Nehemiah's superb organization set to and got their hands dirty. Now, some people reading chapter 3 of Nehemiah might think it's just a boring list of names. But Nehemiah cares about the people, so he records first names and surnames. He can't list all 40 to 50,000 of them, so he often refers to groups of people by the name of the group leader, a bit like house groups, really. Now, the world has the cult of the famous, the celebrity, but the church should be the cult of the ordinary individual. In Nehemiah's workforce, we see rulers with their sleeves rolled up. We see priests not afraid to get their hands dirty. We see goldsmiths used to delicate work, prepared for blisters. Perfume makers with sensitive noses blocked with dust. Servants, soldiers, merchants, a variety of ordinary men and women just getting on with it. And in Nehemiah 4 we read, the people worked hard and we built the walls of Jerusalem halfway up again. But Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the people from the city of Ashdod saw the walls going up and holes being repaired, so they became angry and decided to stir up trouble and to fight against the people of Jerusalem. But we kept on praying to our God, and we also stationed guards by day and night. And the next slide will show us where they're building the walls, but also guarding the building work, ready to defend all 41 sections of the wall, from the sheep gate right round the walls of Jerusalem back to the sheep gate again, was 41 sections. And while they're doing this hard physical labor, they sang. That's the sound of the man working on the chain gang. No, they didn't sing that one, because it hadn't been written. This is the one they sang, and it's written down in Nehemiah chapter 4. Meanwhile, the people of Judah were singing a sorrowful song. I don't know how the tune goes, but these are the words. So much rubble for us to haul. Worn out and weary, will we ever finish this wall? So that's where the song lyrics obviously came from. But working for God on this task wasn't at the expense of their families. Wise leadership from Nehemiah had families linked together, usually working on a section of the wall close to their own homes. That must have been quite useful in combining building work with childcare and meal preparation, and will have given the people a sense of, I'm risking my life to protect my family and my home. In Nehemiah 4 again we read, our enemies were saying, before those Jews know what has happened, we will sneak up and kill them and put an end to their work. On at least 10 different occasions, the Jews living near our enemies warned us against attacks from every side. And so I sent people to guard the walls as its lowest places and where there were still holes in it. I placed them according to families, and they stood guard with swords and spears and with bows and arrows. So Nehemiah is taking precautions because of the real threat to life that that represented. And if we see the next slide that comes up, standing up to the Nazi bully in World War II was a risk not only to those risking their lives in uniform, but to families, including children, at home in places like Southampton. And this is a photograph of the bombing in Southampton, and that's some of the numbers of people that were killed and injured. So what did Nehemiah do is the next question. In Nehemiah's time, the plotting of the enemies of the Jews to kill them shows that the risk was very real. But Nehemiah goes on encouraging the people. We read in chapter 4, then I looked things over and told the leaders, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of your enemies. The Lord is great and fearsome. So think of him and fight for your relatives and children, your wives and homes. The enemies had the whole Samaritan army on their side, and they weren't good Samaritans either. And at their disposal, they had this army, and they were prepared to massacre everyone trying to defend Jerusalem. Nehemiah was trusting in God, But he also believed in keeping his powder dry by taking sensible precautions. And in Nehemiah 4 we read, our enemies found out that we knew about their plot against us, but God kept them from doing what they had planned. So we went back to work on the wall. From then on, I left half of the young men work while the other half stood guard. They wore armor and had spears and shields as well as bows and arrows. The leaders helped the workers who were rebuilding the wall. Everyone who hauled building materials kept one hand free to carry a weapon. Even the workers who were rebuilding the wall strapped on a sword. You see, Nehemiah didn't expect others to work and fight the bullies while he slept in safety. We read that he slept in his work clothes, so he was getting his hands dirty in manual labor as well, with everybody else. Nehemiah led from the front, both figuratively and literally in terms of the battlefront. He took his leadership responsibilities seriously. But you know, at the end of the day, he was just another of the ordinary people making an extraordinary God known, even to the bullies. Coming from far away, just as he was joining in and being transformed into one of the heroes of the faith in this extraordinary God. He and his children slept in their clothes, as did children during World War II, during the Blitz, ready for the air raid siren. And they had a warning signal as well. We read, the worker who was to blow the signal trumpet stayed with me. I told the people and their officials and leaders, our work is so spread out that we are a long way from one another. If you hear the sound of the trumpet, come quickly and gather around me. Our God will help us fight. Every day, from dawn till dark, half of the workers rebuilt the walls while the rest stood guard with their spears. I asked the men in charge and their workers to stay inside Jerusalem and stand guard at night. So they guarded the city at night and worked during the day with a lack of sleep like you get on a youth weekend. I even slept in my work clothes at night, says Nehemiah. My children, the workers, and the guards slept in theirs as well. And we always kept our weapons close by. So when we read of these events so long ago, what should we do in the face of a barrage of bullies? Well, we need to back and encourage Christian leadership, whether it's in church or nationally or with international Christian charities, when they have the courage to stand up for what is right. Intimidation can come from a barrage of bullies, international leaders who don't care about justice, corrupt governments willing to stand by while their people suffer and die. The roll call of the barrage of bullies also includes people traffickers, criminal gangs engaged in slavery, gangmasters exploiting immigrant workers. God, who has a heart for justice, gives us as Christians the responsibility to stand up for the rights of vulnerable people and wants us to have the courage to speak out against the abusers and bullies of this world. Now, we cannot always do this directly, but we should support those Christian leaders and organizations who are in the front line of doing this. And nearer to home, you can also see agencies turning a blind eye while children are bullied into prostitution, or workers are being bullied at work, or children being bullied at school. We may be directly involved when we see bullying at work or are made aware of bullying of our child or children known to us at school. God grant that we may follow Nehemiah's example of dependence on the divine. God grant that we may have an inkling of the intent of God in that situation. And God grant that we might have the courage to stand up to a barrage of bullies wherever we find them. Amen.